Thank you again for having us. As some of you might know, I just got done with the panel before this, so still just trying to get my bearings. So the first thing I'd like to do is introduce who the Red Nation is. So we formed in 2014 out of the desire to contribute to the widespread resurgence of a strong, vocal, and organized anti-police brutality movement that was growing in Albuquerque after the murder of James Boyd, who was an unsheltered man who was shot in the back while camping in the foothills. So from that, the Red Nation was born. But not only from that, the Red Nation understands itself as belonging to centuries-long traditions of resistance to colonialism. The Red Nation is dedicated to the liberation of Native peoples from capitalism and colonialism. We center Native political agendas and struggles through direct action, advocacy, mobilization, and education. We formed to address the marginalization and invisibility of Native struggles within mainstream social justice organizing and to foreground the targeted destruction and violence towards Native life and land. Particularly, we began organizing around border town violence. And when I talk about a border town, I'm not talking about towns located near international borders such as the US-Mexico border. I'm talking about towns that border reservations. Where there's rapid anti-Indian violence that takes place there. So without further ado, I'm just going to briefly go over our 10-point program. We demand an end to violence against Native peoples and our non-human relatives through the reinstatement of treaty rights, full rights and equal protection for Native people, the end to disciplinary violence against Native people and all oppressed peoples, the end to discrimination against the Native silent majority, youth and poor, the ones who are most erased, the end to discrimination, persecution, killing, torture, and rape of Native women. In New Mexico, we currently have the highest rate of missing and murdered Indigenous people in the US. The end to the discrimination, persecution, killing, torture, and rape of Native LGBTQ people. The end to the dehumanization of Native peoples overall. Access to appropriate education, healthcare, social services, employment, and housing. The repatriation of Native lands and lives, and the protection of non-human relatives, the plants, the air, the earth, the water, and 10, of course, the end to capitalism and settler colonialism. Woo. Though the Red Nation comes from various political traditions, indigenous, communist, and socialist traditions, we actually only officially voted that socialism is the primary political ideology of the Red Nation just this year at our last General Assembly. So with that, I'd like to present to you our official organization line on socialism. And I'd like to open with a few quotes that we really look to when we're remembering our place and the inherent socialist nature of indigenous traditions of resistance. The first is from Lee Maricall, who's a First Nations communist. A lot of people know scholars like Glenn Coulthard, who are like open indigenous Marxists. Lee Maricall was the OG. She said, "I firmly believe that the philosophy of my ancestors lines up quite tidily with the philosophy of communism, and I make no apology for my principles." Dennis Binks said, "Native Americans were the first socialists." And of course, Fred Hampton reminds us that socialism is for the people. And if you're afraid of socialism, you're afraid of yourself. His position to the Second General Assembly formally adopts revolutionary socialism and liberation as the primary political ideology of the Red Nation. While incomplete, the purpose of this proposal is to articulate the basic principles of revolutionary socialism and Marxism and its connection to indigenous socialism and communism, the past, present, and future of indigenous struggle. By adopting this proposal, we commit ourselves to the study and practice of revolutionary socialism by aligning ourselves with the long traditions of resistance that predate Marxism itself. Nonetheless, Marxism has become the weapon of the poor and colonized throughout the world and largely outside of Europe, a weapon we now take up as our own. Marxism is a five-fingered fist The hand of the worker, the peasant, the colonized, and our traditions of resistance are the power beyond that fist. Marxism is a tool for making revolution, first and foremost, but it's a useless tool unless wielded properly by the oppressed. Mm-hmm. Our traditions of indigenous resistance wield Marxism not to uphold European traditions, but to emancipate ourselves from the colonizers by destroying that which destroys us, and building and rebuilding our nations according to our traditions and cultures so that our relatives, which include non-humans and people, thus all people, may live. We cannot merely destroy capitalism without the foresight and knowledge of replacing it with a more humane and just system, without rulers and without colonizers. That system is called socialism, which seeks to destroy the class system by destroying the ruling classes and redistributing wealth and restoring dignity to the humble people of the earth. Put simply, socialism is people power. Socialism puts people before profits. Socialism aligns with indigenous traditions of relationality as we seek to be good relatives to other humans and other than humans. Socialism is the natural state of humanity, to live and work towards peace and justice. One. U.S. imperialism is the number one enemy of the planet. Yep. Yeah. Our socialism is rooted in indigenous resistance, African slave rebellions, and European labor history. It is also rooted in the nations of the tricontinental of Asia, Africa, and the Americas that align themselves against the primary enemy of the planet, U.S. imperialism. Indigenous peoples were the first victims of European imperialism and invasion. The U.S. inherited that mantle and has exported the settler colonial project to the rest of the globe by plundering and killing the darker nations, as Vijay Prashad would put it. We are indigenous feminist internationalists. As indigenous nations, who are in the U.S. but not entirely of it, we align ourselves with the third world. We seek to end the oppressive relations between European nations and the third world. This means opposing U.S. imperialism at all turns, denouncing all imperialist wars, and aligning ourselves with the poorer nations of the world in defense of their sovereignty and self-determination. The U.S. must get out of everywhere, including Turtle Island. Woo! Climate change is also not a third world problem, it's a first world problem. Nations like the US consume and produce the most carbon. This concentration of wealth and consumption derives from the histories of African slavery, indigenous genocide, and European settler colonialism. Thus, the struggle against multinational oil and gas corporations is an anti-imperialist struggle in which indigenous nations are leading the fight. But we also recognize that our socialism, our freedom and emancipation can never come at the expense of third world comrades and relatives. Marxism is not European. Socialism is indigenous. Marxism is founded on the expropriated knowledges of non-capitalist indigenous societies. Although Marx himself was wrong about many things, Marxism is a science. It has built-in self-correcting mechanisms that has helped revolutionaries throughout the world build off the political theory Marx first formulated. If this were untrue, there would be no Russian Revolution, no African Revolution, no decolonization movement, no Vietnamese liberation, no Bolivarian Revolution, no Cuban Revolution, Chinese Revolution, etc. Each adopted Marxism and applied it to its specific and unique circumstances by building off the long struggles against exploitation and European imperialism. Even for indigenous peoples in the Americas, the concepts and theories of decolonization explicitly derive from Marxist revolutionary moments. It's dishonest for us to not recognize this history. It's not because of Marx or European thinkers that these revolutions were successful. It's because Marxism is the science of revolution for these poor masses, the colonized, the wretched of the earth. Fundamentally, Marxism is the science of how to get free. It's the study of class struggle. If capitalism upholds the systems of racism, settler colonialism, heteropatriarchy, and imperialism, then we cannot use capitalism to undo these systems. It is not enough to just be anti-capitalist. Mm-hmm. Like our ancestors, we must be forward-thinking by driving from and amplifying our own non-capitalist social relations as Indigenous people. Not to make Indigenous traditions relevant to Marxism or socialism, but to make socialism and Marxism relevant to our struggle as Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. You cannot fight fire with fire. You cannot fight capitalism with Indigenous capitalism.
Yeah. Right.
You cannot fight nationalism with hyper-nationalism. You can only fight fire with water. And the solution to all these ills, and it is what capitalists and colonists hate the most, is socialism. If capitalism is burning the planet, then socialism is the water to douse the flame. Water is life. We all need water to live, but we don't need capitalism. For us to fight colonialism, we must ensure that our nations can live. But our nationalism cannot mirror the bourgeoisie settler nationalism of the colonial states, which is premised on exclusion and white supremacy. We must adopt a revolutionary Indigenous nationalism that aligns with the most oppressed and marginalized first, within and outside of our own communities. And we recognize that by organizing production for our food, medicines, resources, etc., according to need and not profit, is the only possible path moving forward to our traditions. Three, the state and decolonization. We recognize that the colonial state keeps irreconcilable class antagonisms between rich and poor, between settler and native, and the state is first and foremost police and military violence. Its legitimacy is maintained by force. The veneer of representative democracy is only possible because the ruling classes have crushed and will continue to crush any alternative to capitalism by mobilizing police and military. In this sense, Indigenous people are the first Red Scare. Mm-hmm. Because we held land in common and represented the alternative to the settler state, whether it be by taking in escaped slaves or mounting armed resistance, we had to be annihilated. Today, because we adopt revolutionary socialism as our struggle and vision for a free society, we are the second coming of the Red Scare. But we are not exclusive in our struggles for freedom. We align ourselves with all colonized peoples and all oppressed people of the world. Only imperial borders and nation states that are not of our own making divide our common humanity. Therefore, our struggle transcends the state, but we are not naive enough to turn away from the state as a site of struggle. We understand that state power is nearly impossible to achieve since Indigenous people are a minority. Yet, in alliance with other colonized and oppressed people, we can take state power. Not to become the new rulers of a capitalist society, but to use the mechanisms of the state to wage our rightful struggle against our class enemies, the rich. A socialist state uses the power and democracy of the masses to undo privileges and wealth of the ruling class and the colonial elite, even among our own people. A socialist state seeks to destroy itself because it is built in the shell of the old, but it has to be builded by the oppressed in service of the oppressed to achieve freedom and the abolition of the state itself. Because whether we like it or not, the state is a primary organizer of society, and through a decolonized socialist state, we will reorganize society to redistribute wealth and land by taking it back from those who stole it from us in the first place. We recognize the fallacy that capitalists and settlers will simply give up their wealth and privilege if we win their hearts and minds. The wealth and privilege was earned by force, and it will be kept in place by violence. Any challenge to that authority, whether it's democratic, non-violent, will always be met with violence, always. Even the fallacy of democracy is upheld by force. A capitalist government, even if it's democratic, will always serve the interests of the ruling class, no matter how much we reform it. As revolutionaries, our focus is not to organize and appeal to the oppressors for rights. Our role is to organize the oppressed, build democracy from the ground up. We cannot wait for someone else to save us. Only we can save ourselves. Yes. Marxism and socialism takes up the position of the poor. That is why they are derided and hounded by the rich and powerful, because they work in the interests of the colonized and the oppressed. Indigenous liberation is the tip of the spear. Class is fundamentally about power. The class system was imported to our lands, and it upholds racism, sexism, homophobia, and settler colonialism. Indigenous nations are not immune to this system. In fact, many have internalized it as their own. Indigenous nations face a double class oppression, first as native people colonized by a foreign power, and second as poor people. Only revolutionary socialism that seeks decolonization and the abolition of the class system can emancipate us from the ills plaguing our nations. Only through creating a revolutionary organization can we hope to facilitate decolonization on the path towards socialism. No revolution in history has ever come about spontaneously, despite what people might say. The conditions of a rebellion, war, slavery, starvation, may have been spontaneous, but the successful defeat of oppressors always required determined and effective organization of a disciplined and highly trained revolutionary cadre. This is the difference between rebellion and revolution. Rebellion is a temporary protest that seeks the recognition of those in power to change their minds. Revolution seeks to build power from below and doesn't require the recognition of rulers, but seeks to entirely replace them with people power and the organized masses. Rebellion is the NASCAR phase that can lead to revolution, but is not guaranteed. Revolutionaries, however, guide rebellion to revolution. To do so requires a lifetime commitment, building revolutionary organization, which is the vehicle of democracy and struggle and the belief that things can and will change. The Red Nation is a multinational organization representing many different indigenous nations, yet we recognize a common oppression, a common experience among Native people. We are oppressed because of our indigenousness. Therefore, as our name suggests, we are seeking to unify as a nation in this hemisphere and beyond. Our nation is one in which many nations fit. We do not privilege one indigenous experience over the other, whether it be Lakota, Diné, Urban, Rez, Anglo, Spanish, etc. But our diversity and our plurality is our strength. Our diversity and our plurality is our strength, not our weakness. We should actively seek to create and build alliances with non-Indigenous people and struggles, but our primary struggle is dedicated to building our organization and unifying our people and nations. Only a revolutionary organization dedicated to the principles of socialism, equality, democracy, freedom, and Indigenous liberation is capable of doing that work. But we must submit to a collective will for liberation by abandoning bourgeoisie individualism and narrow nationalism. We encourage our membership to develop revolutionary nationalism within their own nation, so long as it is dedicated to the liberation of all people. We also recognize that our traditions have been distorted as tools for oppression. Mm-hmm. If a tradition becomes a shackle, it must be broken. And while our specific nations and the lands in which we may inhabit take priority for our political, cultural, and spiritual development, it should never, ever come at the expense of others or exclude people or beings removed by force or displaced from their homelands. Therefore, the Red Nation may take on national characteristics depending on region and geography, but it is fundamentally dedicated to national liberation for all Indigenous peoples, which is contingent upon the liberation of everyone and everything on this planet.
Hello, my name is Hope. Thank you so much for that introduction. I'm just going to jump right in talking about socialism and why socialism is appealing to me as not only an Indigenous person, but as a Diné person. So one thing, like, I'm aware that actually not a lot of people are aware of, like, conditions in which Native people are living right now. And so that's something that's been very difficult to navigate, just because obviously many people don't have access to that knowledge. And if there is anything that's going on in Indian country, a lot of the times it's not in media. And so a lot of people don't have access to that. And so, to begin, socialism is appealing to me because of the current conditions in which Indigenous people are struggling, especially on our reservations. All Native people have suffered at the hand of colonialism and capitalism. Indigenous people are some of the original socialists and communists, and we still retain that knowledge. And even in practice, socialism is a framework that most engulfs the ways in which we not only communicate with each other as humans, but also communicate with all of our relatives that are non-human. One of the biggest elephants in the room, I would say, is our tribal governments. Dinette is the term that we prefer to use to describe ourselves who belong to the Navajo Nation. And so many people don't know that the Navajo Nation was a tribal entity that formed out of the extractive industry. That is how we got our federal recognition, is through extraction of our own resources, our own relatives. And unfortunately, Navajo Nation has continued that legacy even today, and continues to actually be a barrier for Diné people to organize against capitalism, and against green capitalism even. And so Navajo Nation is not the only nation that has formed this way. There are several other tribal nations that have used, like, this was the structure that they had to adopt to have tribal recognition. Mm-hmm. This was the key to that. So if you look at the Navajo Nation flag, we have oil rigs on it. That should be like a very apparent sign. And our people don't get to say what happens within our tribal governments. We rarely do get a seat at the table to discuss the uranium mines. We have over 500 uranium mines across our reservation, or the fracking. These are all things that have highly impacted our communities in ways that we have never experienced before. It's fairly new, and cancer is rampant amongst our communities. So this has forced my people to learn different ways to engage with each other outside of like the colonial system, and when we venture outside of our reservations. We are forced to depend on each other. We are forced to rely on each other, whether that's for food, water, land. A lot of my people have become indoctrinated into the United States colonial structures, which is like the main problem. And our people need support, but it cannot be through our tribes. It must be through solidarity and through the people. It must be grassroots organizing with people who are directly impacted. It cannot be sitting down with the Navajo Nation president who is misogynistic and sexist and patriarchal. And so with that, I'd like to segue into some of the various different barriers that we've come across organizing in Dinetta area, which is the reservation limits, specifically to do with the nonprofit industrial complex and Big Greens. As some of you may have heard from Jennifer's talk in the last session, a lot of our people get caught up in the moratorium process and the environmental impact statements, and just like the colonial processes that really are meant to just delay and or postpone and or just hide the fact that like the oil and gas industries have already started. And so I think that it's really important that we have a discussion about nonprofits, especially the nonprofit industrial complex. Because I think that there are definitely some advantages that we can use as revolutionaries to further the struggle and further access people who are in the struggle. And so one of the things that I recommend in my experiences is siphoning funds, whether that's like if you're risking arrest to be able to support yourselves while you're like in the midst of direct action, but also allowing and giving access to like people who otherwise don't have any access to knowledge and or resources. But at the end of the day, we need grassroots organizing to work in tangent with nonprofits because they have access to those same resources. However, nonprofits should not be leading the struggle. Marginalized people, colonized people, and oppressed people should. So I think that we're all hopefully pretty much aware of like the different limitations that nonprofits pose to our organizing. I think that's like really important for people to know. And if you don't know, please like do that research. And so I want to share a little bit about how money is understood from a Diné perspective. So our life ways are inherently socialist. Our life ways are, I don't know, I guess plagued due to money. Money is very minimal in my reservation. A lot of people don't have access to employment. People live in third world conditions. They don't have access to like electricity, running water, sometimes even just structures, like just a room to stay in. And so most of my people live in extreme poverty, just as many people across the world do. And so Navajo Nation is, I believe, the second largest tribe with the largest land base. And over 80% of my people are poor. As you get deeper in the reservation, you can see like the survival, the need for people to depend on each other, the need for what we call t'e, which is kinship, to be the primary form of interaction that we have with not only other humans, but as well as like our livestock or our the lands that we caregive, I would rather say, and everything above and between and below. It's really, really important that people understand the conditions in which people are living here in the United States inside these borders, because they're not much different from the way that people are living outside of these borders. And so with that, I segue into the Beyond Borders Caucus that we recently formed that is a part of the Red Nation. We are going to hopefully officially become a caucus in 2 months during our General Assembly and our Native Liberation Conference. And I highly recommend that everybody come through just because it's really important what other people across struggles have to say, especially when it comes to anti-colonial work that we've been doing. And so with that, I'd like to share what Beyond Borders Caucus is. So we formed out of the series of Red Nation delegations to the border in Rarámuri territory. The colonial name for that is Torreón, El Paso, Texas. And so 2 to 3 Red Nation members were involved in the occupation at the Torreón port of entry, where over 3,000 migrant youth were being held. That's when we learned about a lot of the immense violence that's been happening on the inside. One of the things that stood out to us the most was none of the 2,100 staffers had undergone fingerprinting or background checks because it was waived by the Trump administration. In fact, we were told that the workers were hired on the condition that they don't put any of this information or the fact that they're working there on their resumes in order to hide the doings of the Department of Health and Human Services. We also found out that the private religious nonprofit contracted to run the camp Baptist Family Child and Family Services was in fact also at the hands of 14 other concentration camps across Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. Organizers from the occupations carried out various different actions involving trying to interact with staff members who were actually our own people who are poor. And asking them to be a whistleblower and save lives by whistleblowing. Because there is so much violence happening on the inside, and the media was trying to keep it out of the media. And so far to our knowledge, nobody ever called, nobody felt the need to talk about what was going on and what they had seen inside the detention facilities. And so it really just pushed us to remember that, like, we really need to be talking to each other. And we really need to be talking to our communities. We really need to be doing that work, because they are using our people as pawns in the systems of violence. And so we believe that our communities need to play an active role in learning about how the US is criminalizing and incarcerating undocumented people. And quite frankly, just profiting off of their bodies. The lands across what is known as the United States are stolen, taken from indigenous peoples and indigenous nations from across the United States and beyond. Indigenous peoples from various tribal communities have made it a point to welcome migrants and refugees into their communities. I bet you never hear about that. The violence that Customs and Border Patrol has perpetrated on tribal communities whose lands were severed by the border itself continue to experience violence and discrimination on their own ancestral homelands. For example, last year, Border Patrol agents ran over the Toto Atom Native man who was on his own homelands. The Rarámuri Nation, also known as the Tarahumara Nation, is an indigenous community whose community is literally divided by the US-Mexico border wall and extends to what is currently known as Chihuahua, Mexico. The Rarámuri have been challenging the construction of the border for decades, due to the criminalization, incarceration, and brutalization they have experienced from Customs and Border Patrol on their own lands. Many other neighboring tribal communities echo the same experiences of violence and have voiced their concerns. Both federal agencies continue to violate the basic human rights of migrants, refugees, as well as the rights and sovereignty of indigenous peoples whose lands they are currently occupying. And that's where we've seen the widespread hashtags of, like, no deportations on stolen land, no ban on stolen land, no one is illegal, etc. And I encourage everybody to use those. Immigration structures have been terrorizing tribal and migrant communities since their inception. They have enacted the structural conditions in which migrants are dying. Since the creation of ICE, attacks and violence against migrants have increased through the rhetoric of xenophobia and racist practices known as the War on Terror that began after September 11th in 2001. CBP began in 1789 with tariffs and collection agencies that were supposed to be grounded in accumulating capital for the settler state. So we know that this structure was created since the very beginning to exploit people and to exploit any people. The name Border Patrol was given to the agency in 1924, and then in 1952, the United States officially began searching for and policing migrants for deportation. Mexican workers who had originally been persuaded by the United States to come and work here in the agricultural fields, due to labor shortage, were exploited, brutalized, and deported back to Mexico in 1955. This is historically known as the United States' largest mass deportation, where the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service claims they deported over 1.3 million undocumented labor workers. And this CBP campaign was violent, militant, and reflects the history of racism as it was given the name Operation Wetback. These same immigration agencies have used relentless violence against indigenous people and migrants and have both spoken out against detention facilities and the role of the prison industrial complex in the incarceration of undocumented bodies. This violence is not new, but rather we have been conditioned and taught by a revisionist history in our communities that it is. The United States exploits our lack of access to history and uses xenophobic rhetoric to further criminalize undocumented and migrant communities within our own communities. So the issue of water, or I should say water's issue. In this case, the withholding of water and the criminalization of those who provide water to migrants stood out to us most as a powerful and profound connection between seemingly distinct movements. As water protectors, members of the Red Nation know and act on the fact that water is life, or agua es vida. Yet we see that the settler nation state killing refugees by giving them dirty, contaminated, and insufficient water while in custody or preventing them access to water left for their survival. In order for indigenous sovereignty to be in conversation with refugee and migrant struggles, we must remember that our refugees and migrants will remain under threat as long as the settler state continues to dictate who can enter, who can be deported, detained, and killed on stolen land. This is why it is necessary for indigenous people to contest the state's power at all turns by supporting our relatives who are fleeing their homelands due to the United States policies and capitalism, which has created the violence in other people and migrants' homelands in which they are fleeing in the first place. So how many of you know about Southwest Keys? So this will be disturbing. The Southwest Key facility is based out of Texas, which is, according to them, one of the largest nonprofit shelters providing unaccompanied migrant minors or immigrant youth separated from their parents' shelter. Southwest Key is recognized by the United Nations Human Rights Council for excellence in shelter services for unaccompanied migrant youth. The corporation actively detains about one-third of the migrant minors crossing the border. Southwest Key shelters have, however, drawn scrutiny after several instances of sexual assault and abuse in Arizona facilities. The company has 24 permanent concentration camps throughout Texas, Arizona, and California. Two Southwest Key's facilities in Arizona were closed down due to video footage showing violence and sexual assault on youth by Levian Pacheco, a youth care provider in Mesa, Arizona, guilty and convicted of sexually assaulting 9 boys over an 11-month time frame, while also testing positive for HIV and hepatitis C. During his employment, Pacheco had never been required to do a background check in more than 4 months. These facilities were closed for failing to provide documentation that any of their staff members had completed the required background checks. Clearly, these facilities are desperate enough to hire anyone and have used loopholes to hire pedophiles and rapists. And the remaining shelters in Arizona have their licenses revoked, but continue to care for the migrant youth in their facilities. So it's illegally still functioning. It is no surprise that a system built on genocide of indigenous people and the enslavement of African peoples across the continent is currently imprisoning migrant families in concentration camps. Mm-hmm. The United States continues to profit from undocumented bodies, whether they're working in the fields under exploited labor conditions or incarcerated in a detention facility. Undocumented families supply money and labor to the United States but are not given any benefits or protections. The connection between the carceral system, immigration system, and the multi-million dollar corporations is made clear by the notorious example of the Walmart Supercenter in Brownsville, Texas, serving as one of the largest Southwest Key facilities detaining over 1,400 migrant minors. In 2017, large private prisons profited immensely from detaining migrants, including those who weren't in the process of being deported. Asylum seekers, migrants waiting to hear from the immigration court, and those identified for removal. Privatized prisons such as Core Civic Incorporated and Geo Group reaped a combined revenue of $4 billion. There are 100 shelters across the United States incarcerating migrant children. Across 17 states, they have been reported for similar instances of abuse. But who holds these institutions accountable? Ever. And so, that was some of that really, learning all of that information was why we formed the Beyond Borders Caucus. Mm-hmm. Seeing such extreme violence on children who looked like my younger siblings and other young people in my community broke my heart, because the violence that is happening on this land, on our homelands, is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So I have a whole nother section, but it's too long, so I'm just gonna make this like blatantly clear. We are inherently in solidarity with Palestine. And we've seen several correlations between the borders here to the borders there. And we will continue to do whatever in our power as Indigenous people to be in solidarity with Palestine, to support PBS campaigns, and to just support people all across the world who are in struggle. So I'm just going to go over the Beyond Borders purpose and manifesto as quickly as I can. So Beyond Borders is, we are for internationalism and against borders. We seek to build solidarity between marginalized communities the colonizer and settler states try to keep apart. We reject the current notions of citizenship that are built upon the genocide of Native people, exploitation of Native resources, and the labor of all who are poor and colonized. We are anti-colonial, anti-patriarchal, anti-profit, and anti-capitalist at our core. We seek to organize all undocumented people who are still in the shadows, Indigenous, LGBTQ+, farm workers, etc. We want to build solidarity between struggles, regardless of beliefs, languages, or geographic locations. We are explicitly pro-Palestine and demand the abolition of all settler colonial institutions, walls, borders, blockades, checkpoints, and the theft of Palestinian lands from Palestine to Turtle Island. All borders must be abolished for our people to live. We are explicitly anti-colonial and have an Indigenous-centered perspective of migrant justice and organizing that rejects the settler state's notions of citizenship and creates solidarity between Indigenous people and undocumented migrants. We look to queer feminist frameworks of intersectionality to guide our politics, and we ask questions like, what would it look like if Native nations asserted their sovereignty to offer sanctuary to undocumented migrants and refugees? Mm-hmm. We do not support the appropriation of indigeneity by non-Indigenous or detribalized people, but rather the liberation for all colonized people from oppressive institutions. One can participate, liberate, educate without appropriating and further colonizing. We seek to bring solidarity and raise awareness to undocumented, documented, and documented people working in exploitative conditions, especially our relatives in the fields or on the streets. This includes boycotting corporations that do not pay farm workers fair wages, the right to unionize for all, legalization for all, and bringing awareness to the dangerous work conditions in the fields and the human trafficking in undocumented communities. We are informed by the Palestinian struggle for the right of return, the first and second Intifadas, and the international call for BDS. We organize active solidarity with Palestinian struggle, commit to pressuring the United States government to get out of the Middle East, and encourage our members to visit Palestine. And so I'm going to go over our Beyond Borders manifesto. So one, liberation for undocumented relatives is tied to the liberation of Indigenous people. Migrant movements must reject anti-Indianism, anti-blackness, colonialism, and capitalism at all turns. The abolition of the prison industrial complex, ICBP, school to prison detention and deportation pipelines. We seek to liberate all farm workers, laborers, street vendors, sex workers, seasonal workers, housekeepers, janitors, caregivers, wage laborers, homemakers. By that we mean stay-at-home folks, elders, LGBTQ folks, folks in rural places, Indigenous peoples from the outside of the United States, and entire families from labor exploitation in the name of profit. Yeah. 4, We demand an end to U.S. foreign policies that subvert democracy abroad and create the conditions in which poor and colonized migrants are exploited for their labor. And when they are no longer able to produce, they are incarcerated for private detention centers to profit off of their bodies, as they do Black and Indigenous peoples. 5, we demand all forms of incarceration as solutions be to processing migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees end immediately. 6, the migrant justice movement must be aligned with Indigenous and Black liberation. We demand the abolition of all borders from Palestine to Turtle Island. We demand an end to family separation, whether it's in boarding schools, detention and incarceration facilities, concentration camps, foster care systems, and human trafficking. 7, we censor the voices of some of the most marginalized of the marginalized relatives, such as street vendors, LGBTQ plus folks, single parent households, and differently abled folks. We organize in a way that denounces the indoctrination of migrant and Indigenous people to U.S. standards of success and belonging. Instead, we align our struggles and build power. We reject notions of U.S. nationalism and believe that migrants have inherent rights to migration and basic rights regardless of their contributions to or indoctrination in the United States society. Nine, machismo culture is patriarchy, and it must be smashed. There have been femicides of over 2,559 women across Latin America, and to be in solidarity with the movement for missing and murdered Indigenous women across Turtle Island, we demand that all women and femmes live free without fear. 10, we stand by undocumented people regardless of their race, social status, or circumstances. We seek to move beyond the notion of model citizens. 11, we demand an end to all funding for the State of Israel and other settler colonial countries. And we support the right of return for all Palestinians. I think that it's really important to just talk about what folks have already mentioned prior about the relationship to land. Like, all Indigenous people have a right to their own homelands, and they all deserve to go back. We recognize the inherent interconnectedness of all of our struggles. We recognize that without liberations for us, all there will be no freedom for any of us. I would like to conclude my aspect of this presentation with a quote from Harsha Walia's book, Undoing Border Imperialism. Decolonization movements create an alternative to power through committed struggle against settler colonialism, border imperialism, capitalism, and oppression, as well as through the concrete practices that center other ways of laboring, thinking, loving, stewarding, and living. Ultimately, decolonization grounds us in a gratitude and humility through the realization that we are but one part of the land and its creation, and encourages us to constitute our kinship and movement networks back to shared affinities as well as shared solidarities and responsibilities. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hope. So the next thing that I'll be discussing is one of the other recently formed caucuses, which is the Puebla Pueblex Feminist Caucus. And this was voted on as an official caucus just this past year at our last General Assembly. So for those of you who don't know, term Pueblo or Pueblex, the gender neutral term that we're putting forth. Pueblo people are located primarily in New Mexico, and we are of various language groups. I myself am Tewa, and I also have family in Sia Pueblo, which is a Carrie's Pueblo. And Pueblo people are very distinct in the way we
our political and social formations have been informed by really a triple conquest, beginning with Spanish colonization in the 1500s, followed by being occupied by Mexico, and then of course later the US. So we decided to create this caucus because of the very specific conditions that Pueblo people face. In particular, it's notable that there's a very hostile machismo culture that continues to exist, and that's why we include the term feminist, and that's why we seek to articulate what a Pueblo feminist framework is, looking to various other feminists who come out of the third world or who are of colonized peoples. So I'll be using the term PFC for short. The PFC is an official caucus of the Red Nation as of February 2019. The PFC first formed for the Pueblo Feminism Rising Panel, presented at Gallup Pride in 2018, and then later for mapping a Pueblo feminist movement during the American Indian Studies Association Conference in February 2019. The PFC was nationally recognized for this panel by Congresswoman Deb Haaland during the 2019 State of the Indian Nations Address. We are feminists, committed to the liberation and uplifting of all Pueblo people. We center women, LGBTQ2+ people, and gender nonconforming relatives. We emphasize that Pueblo feminism is for everyone, including men. Settler colonialism, heteropatriarchy, white supremacy, and misogyny impact all colonized people. The well-being of Pueblo people and their liberation from settler notions of masculinity is essential to the work we do. All notions of liberation are in accordance with Pueblo core values in oral and written histories and traditions. The PFC absolutely does not seek to uproot, change, or diminish sacred and ceremonial practices that have been in place since time immemorial and prior to colonialism. Again, we serve as a political caucus within the Red Nation, and our purpose is to create a movement that specifically addresses the distinct ways heteropatriarchy, colonialism, individualism, capitalism, and weaponized religion, as well as ableism, have manifested in Pueblo communities. We do this through organizing that includes historical research and analysis, community education and mobilizing, direct action and advocacy. All of the institutions named are those which seek to eliminate us completely, so we call for their abolition. The purpose of this caucus is in accordance with Red Nation's principles of unity and mission and Pueblo cultural core values. While Pueblo feminism is unique in having resulted from specific political, cultural, and religious structures imposed upon us by the occupation of Spanish, Mexican, and United States governments, the Pueblo Feminist Caucus is also realized as belonging to and aligning with traditions of indigenous feminisms, women of color feminisms, black feminist traditions, Marxist feminisms, feminism in the third world, and indigenista theory. We understand the politics of this caucus is rooted in the revolutionary feminist traditions that have long served colonized peoples. We seek to build broad struggle among all colonized people, but center Pueblo people in acknowledgement that the misogynistic violence stemming from the distortion of history that leads our communities to adopt the institutions of heteropatriarchy and weaponize religion as traditional creates a particularly hostile environment for Pueblo femmes and LGBTQ folks and gender nonconforming people. We aim to organize and educate all those seeking freedom from the violence of heteropatriarchy, white supremacy, capitalism, etc., and strive for honoring truly traditional Pueblo governance structures by restoring a balance of power among all genders that enables collaborative cooperation and development of a life-affirming world for ourselves and all our relations of the earth. We work in this caucus to dismantle toxic systems and build power, infrastructure, and community that will turn back the tides of destruction that diminish our sacred way of life as Pueblo people. So where does the name come from? With our feminist politics in mind, we propose to contest the term Pueblo that has been imposed upon us by Spanish colonial settlers to describe a vast number of nations with distinct languages and cultural values. Mm-hmm. We encourage the use of our own terms for our nations and linguistic groups. We understand that Pueblo has been adopted and embraced by our nations, communities, and individuals to signify our understanding that there's power in referring to ourselves as a collective people. We seek to challenge the masculinized term Pueblo by taking into consideration the use of the feminine term Puebla as used by our relatives in various regions throughout Mexico. We seek to consider making the term void of gendering as is seen with the term Chicanx, Latinx, Filipinx, etc. Currently, many other movements seek to degender Latin languages that are typically gendered languages. This is a step toward deconstructing the gender binary and ensuring the language we use is always inclusive of gender nonconforming relatives. We include the word feminist in the title of our caucus to indicate our mission to create a Pueblo liberation movement that must be inherently feminist in nature, meaning it must center femmes, LGBTQ folks, and gender nonconforming people to be liberatory at all. We also have a brief 6-point program to address some of the specific issues we face as Pueblo people, the first being the end to heteropatriarchal violence. European settlement depended on the dissolving of indigenous governance structures to assert authority, and for this reason, violence upon queer and feminine bodies was used as a primary tactic for the obliteration of indigenous governance structures, because indigenous bodies stand in the way of access to the land, and because women are seen as the producers of native nations through the European heteropatriarchal lens. Violence against women, particularly sexual violence, is used as a means of separating native people from the land. Mm-hmm. Women and queer individuals, especially when in positions of power, become the biggest threat to settler projects of dispossession. Sexual violence is such an effective tool of conquest because of the overwhelming damage it inflicts upon families that lasts for generations, mm-hmm. instilling shame and humiliation that discourages any efforts to resist. We demand the end to the perpetuation of sexist, transphobic, and homophobic violence and machismo culture within our communities. We demand safety and respect for all Pueblex women and LGBTQ individuals. We demand an end to all sexual abuse, physical abuse, spiritual abuse, psychological abuse enacted upon Pueblex people. 2, the end of excommunication and disenrollment on the basis of blood quantum. The infamous Indian killer, Andrew Jackson, suggested that intermarriage between white settlers and Native women would result in assimilation, the assimilation of Native peoples, and thus the assimilation of Native lands. The idea that whiteness could somehow overpower or dilute indigeneity on a biological level is what has led to the creation of the blood quantum system, a system also crafted to place indigenous people on an inevitable trajectory towards total disappearance. Mm-hmm. With the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, blood quantum laws were applied to all Native nations and had to be met in order to maintain federal recognition. This required that all citizens of a Native nation meet the blood quantum criteria of at least 1/4 Indian blood. We know that our tribes depend on maintaining blood quantum to continue receiving federal benefits that are vital. However, continued participation in the eradication of our own nations will never be beneficial to our continuance as Pueblo people. We demand an end to self-elimination via excommunication and disenrollment of Pueblo people on the basis of blood quantum. Blood quantum is contradictory to Pueblo notions of kinship, clanship, and belonging, mm-hmm. and identity that are traditionally situated by matrilineality. We have long shared lineage with surrounding tribes prior to colonization, and this did not diminish our ties to our nations. Ultimately, cultural participation and contributions to our families and community affirm belonging. 3, we demand an end to the weaponization of religion and toxic traditionalism. Critiques of traditionalism have been articulated by indigenous feminists already. We are using the term toxic traditionalism to specifically describe unchanging values mixed into our culture as a result of colonialism and deliberate tactics to obstruct our way of life in order for us to submit to colonizing governments. Keeping those traditions simply because they have become traditions. We can also look at toxic traditionalism as the distortion and weaponization of tradition and how we use those tactics on ourselves. We emphasize that toxic traditionalism does not apply to all traditions or the sacred and ceremonial. The normalization of sexist violence is often conflated with tradition and even accepted as unchangeable or even on par with Pueblo core values. PFC seeks to provide counter-narrative to the normalization of sexist violence, citing the same core values and oral histories that are often wielded against us. Toxic traditionalism further erases women and queer folks. keeping them in submissive positions within our communities, and seeks to prioritize the voices and opinions of only cisgender heterosexual men, and aims to silence any opinions or views that are contradictory to it. Through toxic traditionalism and the weaponization of religion, some individuals in positions of power abuse aspects of traditional and sacred knowledge by either keeping it to themselves and shaming those who don't know or haven't had access to the same knowledge, or simply because they don't fit the cishet male identity, keeping an oppressive imbalance of power in place. We demand an end to the use of toxic traditionalism and weaponized religion. We demand that the voices of women and LGBTQ people are heard, and that their liberation be put at the forefront of our liberation as Native peoples. Four, an end to the exploitation of Pueblo culture, sacred knowledge, and objects. For generations, Pueblo people have been dependent on the Indian art and tourism industry for basic income. Though the art and culture of Pueblo people should continue to be celebrated, these industries are notorious for their exploitative practices. From the theft of sacred objects to the divulging of sacred knowledge and mistreatment of Native artisans, these industries profit off our labor while commodifying our culture. Yet Pueblo people suffer from some of the worst rates of poverty in New Mexico, while the elite who consume Native art and control these industries live in luxury on Pueblo lands. We demand an end to the exploitation of Pueblo culture, peoples, and sacred objects. We demand that sacred items and objects be repatriated, and that Native artists and laborers no longer be exploited. Five, we demand an end to the glorification of the genocide of Pueblo people. Pueblo people are constantly reminded of their genocide through revisionist history, colonial imagery, and celebrations that glorify our conquest by the Spanish crown and the U.S. Empire. We have continually resisted the erasure of Pueblo's resistance to conquest and fought to have our history accurately taught in educational institutions. Presently, statues of Spanish and U.S. colonizers are proudly displayed. Our lands and sacred sites still bear the names paying homage to conquest, and the educational texts at all levels of academia remain inaccurate, incomplete, or blatantly revised. These are not simply symbolic issues or issues of representation. They reflect the very real ongoing climate of violence against indigenous people. Mm-hmm. We demand that all racist imagery and celebrations of conquest and colonization be abolished. We demand that all narratives that ignore the ongoing violence against Pueblo people in all forms end. We call for the installation of an accurate Pueblo-driven curriculum to replace the revisionist history curriculum at all levels of public and private academic institutions. We demand that Pueblo students have access to culturally relevant curriculum and language classes. Six, we demand an end to land loss at the hands of corporate and settler interest. Popular tourist sites such as the Ojo Caliente Hot Springs and the city of Los Alamos sit atop some of the most sacred locations in the Tewa world. Mm-hmm. Likewise, the development of resorts and campsites in the Jemez Mountains and Santa Fe Mountains serve a primarily white upper class customer base. Not only does the presence of popular tourism sites disrupt our relationship to the land by decreasing ancestral hunting and gathering grounds, the communities that are most impacted seldom see significant revenue from these tourist attractions. Los Alamos National Labs and the presence of the Jacpel uranium mine in Laguna Pueblo are some of the first sites of the nuclear industrial complex and continue the project of the militarization of Pueblo lands. Mm-hmm. It is a disturbing irony that among one of the holiest places in the Tewa world, the most deadly weapon in all human history was created, the atomic bomb. The devastation of the nuclear bomb began not in Japan, but right here in New Mexico. Well, we're not in New Mexico. With Pueblo people as its first victims, who are still suffering the long-term health impacts of exposure to radioactivity. We demand an end to all projects of resource extraction, militarism, corporate and settler projects on Pueblo lands. And to end, I'd just like to remind everyone that Pueblo feminism is for everyone. All Pueblo people suffer the impacts of heteropatriarchy, white supremacy, settler colonial violence, and resource extraction under the nightmare of capitalism. We are impacted collectively by these systems, regardless of gender or sexuality, and it is our collective duty to care for and uplift each other by unlearning the ways we might actively uphold these oppressive institutions and educate ourselves about how we can actively dismantle them. For our culture, traditions, language, and lands to continue to exist, heteropatriarchy, white supremacy, settler colonialism, and resource extraction, and of course capitalism must die.